From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. I'm pretty sure you know who this is.
I'm an angry mom, and I want answers to my questions.
Cindy Sheehan lost her son Casey, a Humvee mechanic, on April 4, 2004. He was one of eight soldiers killed in Baghdad, Sadr City that day by rocket-propelled grenades and small arms fire. Earlier this month, she made her way to the president's ranch in Crawford and then settled in to sit and wait and give interviews and wait and greet other grieving moms and wait for the president to give her a reason for the war and to hold him accountable for Casey's death. Late this week, she took a temporary leave when her mother had a stroke. But her quest has drawn multitudes to Crawford, and that doesn't even count the press.
It started out as a grieving mom on a lawn chair demanding to see the president. Now, Cindy Sheehan speaking for the nation's anti-war movement. Tonight, we're live from Crawford, Texas, with Cindy Sheehan.
What should we do about mother? Discrediting her is frustrating work. You can hear it in Rush Limbaugh's voice.
Her story is nothing more than forged documents. There's nothing about it that's real. It's nothing more than an attempt. It's the latest effort made by the coordinated left.
But defending her is as easy as apple pie. Air America's Randy Rhodes.
God forbid the story gets out that Cindy Sheehan is just a mom.
This week, Cindy Sheehan was the most cited person on Blog Pulse, a site that tracks chatter in the blogosphere, edging out customary frontrunner President Bush and an earlier challenger, Harry Potter. In those many blogs, Sheehan has been called everything from a saint to a whore, the voice of reason and the voice of treason. And not just in blogs, Fox's Bill O'Reilly.
I think Mrs. Sheehan bear some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
As her conservative critics find evidence in past statements to besmirch her name, liberal fact-checkers seek to clear it, demonstrating just how the Drudge Report took her words seemingly praising the president when they met last year out of context, how she never said her son died for Israel. And as the argument grows louder, those talk show hosts who decline to condemn or canonize her only make it worse by taking the only other available route they know. They punditize her. MSNBC's Chris Matthews asked her to compare the campaign in Afghanistan to Iraq, and she didn't make a distinction.
The Taliban was harboring Al-Qaeda, which is the group that attacked us on 9/11.
Well, then we should have gone after Al-Qaeda and maybe not after the country of Afghanistan.
But that's where they were being harbored. That's where they were headquartered. Shouldn't we go after their headquarters? Doesn't that make sense?
It would have been better if she'd simply kept mum. And she probably knows that.
I'm not a strategist. I'm not a military strategist.
She's just a mom. And mindful of charges of political exploitation, Sheehan has bid the activists in her midst to take a back seat. She's moving camp closer to the president, courtesy of a kindly Crawford neighbor, and only moms and some dads get to go. One writer on the liberal blog The Daily Kos would surely approve and urge her to move further in that direction. He wrote, "We should call her Mother Sheehan. We should never call her Cindy. I don't know her. Mother Sheehan is her title and expresses her ceremonial status as a bereaved mother calling forth over the dead body of her son." That's a little Machiavellian, perhaps, or Rovian, but fiendishly clever, because for the media, mother is very nearly an immovable object. You can't knock her down, you can't blow her over, and as frustrating as it may be to some, she's particularly hard to rush.
Most people, and I'll lump myself in with this crowd, in talking about Cindy Sheehan, always offer the predicate that it's terrible she lost her son, and we grieve with her, and we're far sorry for her, and all that, and then it's followed by a but. Now, why are people doing this? Why are people saying, well, we're sorry, but she lost her son, and it's got a terrible thing to go through, and but. Because people are afraid of criticism.
But why?
Why should a mother have more moral authority on a particular issue than a father or the average person on the street?
It's a cultural thing, a very old cultural thing, the spiritual power projected on the bond between mother and child, a kind of purity that transcends politics and repels partisan attack, no matter how harsh. Jean Bethke Elstein, author of Political Mothers, says that a mother's moral authority only increases when her child dies.
And there's something that kicks in when you think mother-child. You think of someone young, vulnerable, dependent.
Sculpted by Michelangelo, perhaps?
Yes, exactly. The image of this suffering mother, the image of Madonna and child. And you don't think of a grown-up adult son who reenlisted to fight a war.
The mothers who finally brought an end to the notorious dirty war in Argentina made powerful use of that imagery. From 1976 to 83, people disappeared off the streets of Argentina every day. Many young students never heard from again. The mothers of the disappeared began to gather on Thursdays in a Buenos Aires square, walking in pairs because it was illegal to assemble in groups, without their husbands because it was not safe for them. Diana Taylor is the author of Disappearing Acts, Spectacles of Gender and Nationalism in Argentina's Dirty War.
There's a deep investment in the maternal in every society, and that's why it's so potent, because it's not an attack that's coming from the outside. It's coming from the very fiber of that society.
In Argentina, political activism was strictly forbidden, but the grieving mothers, at least while they stayed in the square, were seemingly untouchable.
They looked like matronly, middle-aged women. They wore flat shoes, and they started carrying the ID cards of their missing children, saying, these people existed, they've disappeared, we don't know where they are, you know where they are, we want you to be held accountable.
Years of silent maternal reproach bore down on the dictatorship and strengthened the resistance, and eventually the government fell. Very soon, mothers' movements emerged in Chile, Bolivia, Guatemala, Serbia, Chechnya, and elsewhere, recognizable because of the pictures they carried of the children no longer with them.
And if you also look at what happened with the families here of 9/11, when they went to testify before the commission, they were also carrying those photographs of their children. So these were a kind of a strategy that they had all taken up from the mothers' movement in Argentina.
In 2000, Diana Deese Thomases organized the Million Mom March for stronger gun control regulations, one of the biggest protest marches in U.S. history.
I wish I could tell you that I was a scholar of women's movements, but I wasn't. What I learned at the Million Mom March, and I really didn't have any background in this until the Million Mom March, that women are natural organizers after they have children. Suddenly you're organizing carpools, you're organizing field trips, you're on the PTA, suddenly moms are joining the NAACP. Issues that affect them become more important, I think, once you have children.
But eventually the mothers, defined in these movements as mothers and only as mothers, need allies who know how to wheel and deal and make things happen in an impure world. Jean Bethke Elstein.
Over time, the symbolic appearance of grieving mothers in the public square begins to lose its force. In a sense, you've made your point. Now politics has to take over.
But beware. The gun lobby accused the Million Mom March of playing politics when it found common cause with political allies. Cindy Sheehan is also vulnerable on that score, as she's beginning to learn. Again, Jean Bethke Elstein.
You're playing a very delicate game there, because if at some point your use of that imagery can be seen to be highly partisan, then the moral authority starts to drain away from it.
And therein lies the dilemma for mothers and mothers' movements. They are powerful because they are perceived as pure. They grab attention across the political spectrum precisely because they transcend politics. But the political arena is where change happens. A Madonna has no place there. Once she enters, she's no purer than Dad.
Mm-hmm.
And now for a few of your letters. 2 weeks ago on the show, author David Goodman recalled the work of New York Times reporter William L. Lawrence, handpicked by the War Department during World War II to write pieces praising the atomic bomb and to deny the reality of radiation sickness. For Gerald M. Clark of New York City, that conversation sparked a memory of very different coverage. Quote, "The New Yorker magazine in 1946 published a whole issue devoted to John Hersey's devastating description of the effects of the bomb as told by survivors. I was especially interested, having just come back from the Navy in the Pacific, when ABC Radio had the article by John Hersey read aloud in prime time on the full network by Madeline Carroll. Sections ran on several consecutive evenings, as I remember it. You could not fail to tune back. Like everyone who heard it, I was appalled. And just 20 years old, I had to think about my own luck in my 2-year naval service. I figured that as grotesque as the effects of that bomb were, it had spared my buddies and me from kamikaze and torpedo attacks. It's amazing how fast self-interest kicks in to one's moral calculations."
Several listeners were pretty annoyed after I gave them the ending of the movie Million Dollar Baby last week. Ian Miller writes, "There are few practices as rude as ruining a movie for someone who hasn't seen it. I don't usually associate your program with thoughtlessness, but you certainly were yesterday. You owe your listeners who haven't seen the movie an enormous apology." Likewise, this from Michael Baker. "I haven't seen someone destroy a film for me since a friend said after The Crying Game, 'I'm not going to tell you anything about it, but the chick is a guy.' Thanks, Michael. I haven't seen The Crying Game yet." Actually, I have. But here's my question. What's the statute of limitations on this thing? Million Dollar Baby was released last winter. It won the Oscar. It's in video. I mean, how long before it's safe to say Rosebud was a sled?
Write in with your complaints about that Rosebud gaffe, about The Crying Game, or the fact that you know that Tony Perkins dressed up as his mother in Psycho, to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Coming up, reporting on the Gaza pullout from both sides of the barricades, and happy, shiny news for happy, shiny people.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In November 1967, the United Nations Security Council adopted Resolution 242, which called for the, quote, withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. The recent conflict was a 6-day war between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Jewish soldiers captured land from Syria to the north, Jordan to the east, and Egypt to the south. And the UN resolution asserted that Israel, in exchange for a recognized right of security and sovereignty, should give it back. The quid pro quo of Resolution 242 has become the foundation of a 38-year stalemate now codified in the phrase land for peace. It formed the basis of the 1979 Israel-Egypt peace treaty, when Israeli forces voluntarily withdrew from the Sinai Peninsula. And it remained the guiding principle this week as the world's media covered the removal of Jewish settlers, sometimes forcibly, from the Gaza Strip and parts of the West Bank.
Nearly 9,000 residents in 25 neighborhoods stood face to face with Israeli troops who carried eviction notices and no guns. Scenes of tearful evacuations and angry standoffs made for compelling reportage in a region where journalism, like land and like history, is up for grabs. Michael Young of the Beirut-based Daily Star will join us soon to survey some of the reaction in the Arab press. But first, J.J. Goldberg, editor of the Jewish weekly The Forward, has been following the press coverage in Israel and some in the States. He joins me now. J.J., welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, Brooke.
So at the heart of this evacuation is tension in Israeli society between mainstream secular Jews and those in the settlers movement. Do we see this tension in the recent coverage of the Gaza pullout?
I think there was a sense in the Israeli media this week, especially building over the last few weeks, that the goals of the settler movement and the goals of mainstream Israeli society used to dovetail, and they don't any longer. Israel saw the territories as a defense forward position. The settlers saw them as a divine promise. Haaretz captured it in an editorial this week. They said, those who still see the knitted skullcaps, that is the modern Orthodox Jews, as the best and brightest of our youth, who think their contribution to the country and the army is priceless, hope that the moment of truth, the revolt against the evacuation, will not erupt. But in recent days, the concern has arisen that the line has been crossed. The protest has become a revolt.
And Haaretz, you would define as a very mainstream paper in Israel?
Haaretz is often called the New York Times of Israel. It's also quite liberal.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the largest circulation. The largest circulation paper is Yediot Achronot. It's a tabloid. Its editorial line is kind of gritty liberalism. And their main political reporter, essentially the dean of Israeli political reporting, Nachum Barnea, combination of, I guess, Jimmy Breslin and David Broder. He wrote this week, I'm going to translate now, the picture appears to be of a great deal of sadness, the soldiers and the settlers weeping together. Now he writes, excuse me, but that scene strikes me as confusing. In the army that I grew up in, crying was simply not an option, certainly not weeping over tragedies that can be repaired, like tile roofs, cinder blocks, and attractive bathroom fixtures. In other words, it's become a national day of mourning when essentially what it is the army trying to create a new defense line.
What about the national religious papers or the conservative papers? Obviously, they're not going to share the position of the two papers you mentioned, that the time has come to make this shift. We were wrong.
Well, bear in mind, the national religious and the conservative are two different groups. The conservative press, Ma'ariv, which is a smaller tabloid, or the Jerusalem Post, which is a pro-Likud daily in English, take the view that you don't reward terrorists, and therefore Israel should stay put in the territories until it's got a real partner. So they're not in principle against ever giving up territory. They're essentially neoconservative. And they've taken the view that this is a mistake, it's bad timing, and they're sympathizing with the settlers who were the brave pioneers. The national religious press, Arutz Sheva, for example, is a settler radio station. It's been filled with posts this week saying this is the saddest day, talking about the expulsion victims feeling lost, about having no home. Soldiers are reported to be unable to complete their mission. There's a deep feeling that sooner or later God's going to come to his senses and prevent this from happening.
How are the press treating Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon? He was elected in 2001 partly on a platform that opposed disengagement from Gaza, and obviously experience has led him to change his mind. How is he faring in the press? Predictably being treated as a sensible man of reason on one side and as the ultimate betrayer on the other?
It's pretty much predictable in that sense. You get an awful lot in the Orthodox press of Sharon as a dictator. At times, there's even talk of him being satanic. Some of this has come across here in the Jewish press, capital P. It's published in Brooklyn. It reflects the views of the settler movement. And there's been a fair amount about the junta that governs Israel now, or is knuckling under to unbearable pressure from the Bush administration, which sometimes gets the blame. In the mainstream press, Sharon is regarded as an Israeli everyman.
You mentioned the Jewish press, the national religious press that's published in Brooklyn. I was wondering, can you make a clear distinction between the mainstream American press and the Israeli press coverage?
The American press has had a lot of coverage, especially this week, of the sadness of Israeli society. And when you have anti-settler coverage, it's primarily from Palestinian commentators who are glad that the settlers are leaving. In Israel, you have a phenomenon that you don't find here of mainstream commentators who dislike the settlers and dislike Orthodox Judaism, the sort of fundamentalism that they see. Jews in America are uncomfortable disliking Orthodox Judaism. There is a sense that if it's more Jewish than I am, it's got to be good. And so people look over their right shoulders for approval in America, and the mainstream press doesn't want to take on the Jewish community in that sense. They don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism. So you're not going to get people talking about a form of Judaism that has brought about conflict.
J.J. Goldberg is the editor of The Forward, a weekly Jewish newspaper published in New York City. J.J., thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If the Israeli press focused mostly on the plight of the evicted settlers and the future of their state, it wouldn't be surprising to learn that the Arab press has cast its attention elsewhere. Michael Young is an opinion columnist for the Daily Star of Lebanon and has monitored outlets throughout the entire region. He joins us now from Beirut. Michael, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your own paper. You've described Daily Star columnist Rami Khoury as, in your words, unmoved by the settlers' plight.
Rami, who is incidentally originally Palestinian, if I might as well just quote him, as he put it, press depictions of the Gaza settlers' emotional pain at being sent back to Israel lack both credibility and relevance, as he put it. Forcing a thief to stop stealing is not an act that should be depicted as inflicting pain on the criminal, but rather as forcing the criminal to abide by the law. So rather tough words, and in a sense, reflective of a widespread view in the Arab press in the Middle East that the settlers who were removed, their fate reflected the fate of the Palestinians half a century ago.
Now, if the Arab press is not focusing on the emotional drama, what is it focusing on?
By and large, the Arab press has looked at the politics of what has happened. And the general consensus in the Arab press has been that this is basically a plan by Ariel Sharon and the Israeli government to pull out of Gaza, to essentially get rid of about 1.5 million Palestinians, to get that demographic headache out of the way. And in a sense, to put the rest of the peace process in deep freeze, so that Israel won't have to make any further concessions in the West Bank, or minimal concessions. So that's the general view in the Arab press, and to a certain extent that has also been reflected in Israeli commentary quite a bit as well.
Michael, it's easy to understand why the Arab world would be suspicious of Sharon's motives in pulling out of Gaza, but considering the violent display of emotion within Israel and Gaza about the pullout, is there no sentiment reflected in the Arab press that maybe this is actually genuine progress?
Sure. Initially, it was essentially regarded as a ploy. In the last few days, the mood in the Arab media has been much more, nuanced than it was a few months ago. And the reason for that suddenly is that the different parties to the conflict realize that there are different stakes involved in the Gaza withdrawal, and that indeed they can take advantage of it for political reasons.
Tell me about the pan-Arab satellite channels. How have they portrayed the events of the past week?
It's been a satellite story in the sense that even in Lebanon, for example, yesterday, the television station of Hezbollah, the Al-Manar, made a point of having live feed from there with their correspondent speaking to different people. This is obviously, at least from Hezbollah's angle, a victory that should be taken advantage of. Hezbollah is obviously close to the Hamas movement, and they want to show that the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, in a way, was very similar to the one from South Lebanon in 2000, that this was the fruit of militancy, of resistance. On the other hand, the other satellite stations, I mean, Al-Arabiya, for example, which tends to be much more center of the road, has been less blatant politically in its coverage.
Tell me what the spin is from the Hamas media operation. I think people in the States think of Hamas strictly as a terrorist organization, but obviously it has become a very substantial political institution and has an enormous media presence.
Sure. Hamas is a monument to subtlety when it comes to its rhetoric. It always tends to mix very fierce rhetoric with a certain willingness to accept political reality. For example, there was an interview published with the London-based Saudi newspaper Al-Sharq Al-Awsat, in which one of the senior Hamas officials said, and I quote, "The resistance must move to the West Bank to drive out the occupation. We will not take the Gaza Strip and flee to a state of calm and tranquility while the Zionist enemy continues to detain thousands of our sons and while it occupies the West Bank." So that was a very, very tough statement. On the other hand, there have been indications that Hamas will continue the truce and that it will very probably do so as to consolidate its power in liberated Gaza. I suspect also because it does not really want at this stage to enter into a conflict with the Palestinian Authority. And I think the different Palestinian parties want to avoid entering into effectively a civil war because they feel, and indeed the Israelis to a certain extent have made clear that this was their intention, they feel that the Israeli ploy was to let the Palestinian Authority and the Islamists fight over Gaza.
Okay. Well, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Young is opinion page editor and columnist for the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon. I have the most wonderful news. And it's not this.
Tonight, the only known survivor of an attack by the BTK serial killer. His sister was murdered, but he got away. Terrorist cells in America, we knew they were here. Plus, hundreds of thousands of married men and married women logging onto a website for cheaters, a web of deceit.
That totally harshed my mellow, man. That's the aggravating thing about the news. It's so freaking depressing. My fifth grade teacher, Miss Cooper, used to say that newspapers should devote a day to printing only good news, uplifting stuff about good deeds and kitty cats rescued from trees and schools opened in Iraq. I shared the scheme with my mom, who rolled her eyes and said Miss Cooper should stick to teaching arithmetic and beating the ADD kids with her ruler. But lo and behold, four decades later, someone has realized Miss Cooper's fondest dream. HappyNews.com forsakes war and famine, terror and man's inhumanity to man 24/7. Byron Reese is the publisher, and he joins me now. Byron, welcome to OTM.
Hi.
Give me an example of the kind of story that shows up on happynews.com.
You'll see a lot of the same categories as you would on a conventional news site. There's international stories, national news, local news, sports, entertainment. We just try to focus on the stories that are positive and upbeat. I think today there's a story about a man in New York who caught a six-year-old child who was falling off the third-floor balcony. We cover a peace march in Israel, an 89-year-old man who's biking for a cure for multiple sclerosis.
The other top stories are free flights Thursday on Asiana Airlines, England spends $7 million to move dead bugs, and Al-Qaeda leader killed. Now, that's interesting because while I suppose it's good news in the war against terror, it's kind of a grim scenario. Does the death of a terrorist leader really fit into your overall scheme of not confronting readers with the grim realities of the world we live in?
The site's purpose isn't to insulate people from the bad that goes on in the world. Obviously, there's a lot of good and bad news that you need to know about. But to answer your question, yes, there's always a lively debate around the newsroom about what kinds of stories qualify for happy news. And that one, of course, engendered a certain amount of debate. Somebody pointed out, you know, if Hitler had died, we certainly would run that. I mean, it would be a great story any way you look at it. I guess we believe that Al-Qaeda, who target civilian targets, that any decrease in their ability is good news. But there's no such thing as the perfectly good news story that everybody in the entire world sees as unquestionably good news. The rule around the office is that 95% of the people in our readership would perceive it as good news.
I'm curious, considering almost by definition most news is bad news, where you find all the good news?
That's an interesting assertion that most news is bad news, and I would question it. It really boils down to the question of what is news. And I would say news should give you an accurate portrayal of the world around you. There's an interesting graph recently put out by the Center for Media and Public Affairs, and it showed the incidence of murder in the 1990s in the U.S. Every year it's been falling. But it also graphed it with the three networks' coverage of murders every year, and they rise every year, so that you're getting safer and safer every year, but media is training you to be more and more scared every year.
The headline, "Byron Reese Walks Down the Street Is Not Struck by Falling Piano," is never going to show up in a newspaper because that's the norm. The news is, generally speaking, that which is not the norm. So if you get hit by a falling piano, I got to say it's bad news, but it's a pretty good story.
But let me just tell you two scenarios. You know, one would be a woman who drowns her children in a bathtub someplace in the country, and another one about a woman who runs into a burning building to save somebody's children. I mean, both of those are equally out of the norm, right? They're both news, but one of them is going to get a huge disproportionate amount of coverage. Our biggest asset in finding happy news stories are our citizen journalists. And what they are people all over the world who are kind of our eyes and our ears on the street. So you should see a plethora of stories on the site that aren't covered anywhere else because they just never rise to the attention of traditional media.
Do you find yourself getting flacked by people who have, let's just say, image problems? I'm thinking, for example, of the Pentagon, who realized that, you know, here's an opportunity to tell a story outside of the boundaries of the mainstream media and maybe for once manage perceptions by speaking to happynews.com.
We're never going to be a mouthpiece for some organization to further their portrayal of the world. We have traditional journalists on staff who subject our stories to the same kind of objective journalistic scrutiny that other news organizations use. I mean, we see all the same press releases everybody else does, and you're right, 90% of them are their spin on things. We never spin the news. We never take a story and say, okay, how can we make this not sound as bad as it is? You know, on 9/11, we wouldn't have said, you know, 3,000 buildings in New York untouched by aircraft, because that would have been a disservice to the truth behind the story.
Well, Byron, what else can I say? I'm very happy to have spoken to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy as well.
Byron Reese is the publisher of happynews.com.
Coming up, the music industry cares deeply about piracy, except when it doesn't. And one soldier's hip-hop experience in Solder City.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
When a soldier ends his life with his own gun, Beaker's trying to figure out what to tell his son. Beaker's oil prices.
That's Mos Def from a hip-hop mixtape. The West Bank and Gaza Strip. Mixtapes began as documents of street parties in 1970s New York. They were, in fact, cassette testaments to a DJ's ability to move a live crowd. Over time, though, mixtapes evolved, making use of unreleased music to keep fans ahead of the mainstream. Sold illegally on the street, in some stores, and increasingly on the internet, DJs now act as curator and MC on mixtapes, now on CD, of course, introducing songs leaked to them from the music industry. These leaks entice hungry audiences and allow the music industry to build street buzz for new songs and new artists. But the very nature of mixtapes, occupying a shadowy realm very close to industry-approved piracy, presents an uneasy contradiction for a business on a high horse about music theft. Oliver Wang is a journalist and scholar who's written about mixtape culture. He says this new incarnation of the mixtape was driven by DJs scrambling to make themselves known.
And what happened was the competition between DJs to distinguish themselves led them to start to try to acquire what's known as exclusives, which are basically unreleased songs or advanced songs that other DJs couldn't acquire. So that the bragging rights that these mixtape DJs were going for was who could have the mixtape that had the most exclusive and the most unique material on it. And gradually this created a relationship between the mixtape DJ and record labels, where if the labels gave the right song to the right DJ who had a big following, this is a way that they could get out certain songs they wanted to sort of test to a market and get some advanced buzz on.
The release of these songs to people who would make mixtapes isn't, strictly speaking, legal, and yet the industry seems to participate in it, right?
Most mixtapes are still technically illegal, and so they're not using materials that have been cleared and have been paid for, but it's an understanding between the label that if we give you this and you help promote our song, the labels are willing to look the other way.
But meanwhile, the music industry has been waging this very vocal war against piracy, and Bush just appointed a piracy czar. But haven't there been some recent busts of music stores where a Recording Industry Association of America representative is standing there with the police to crack down on mixtapes in record stores?
Sure. I think the most recent really public example has been Mondo Kim's, which is a record store in the East Village in New York City. And from what I understand, someone from Sony had gone into the store to buy some music and noticed some mixtapes that contained material from a Sony artist that they didn't consider to be legal. And that's when they called in the RIAA to come in and grab that stock and arrest the employees of the store. People were a little taken aback by that kind of measure, because if you're talking about illegal street tapes in New York, the amount of Kim stock is so minuscule, it's almost laughable. You could just walk down Canal Street and you can find dozens of people selling mixtapes. The problem that Kim's ran into, really, is they had the wrong person from the wrong place come and shop at their store.
I just don't understand how the music industry can be so morally upright about piracy when sanctioning it on Canal Street, not sanctioning it at, say, Kim's record store in New York City. The industry is essentially changing its rules, breaking its own rules. Do you see this as hypocrisy or just savvy marketing?
I think the difference between them is the kind of piracy that the record industry is really afraid of is where people are taking entire albums. That prevents a sale from happening of a legitimate album that a record label is going to profit from. So if the bottom line is selling CDs, if the mixtape assists that, then they're willing to look the other way.
But if the future of the record industry, as many people say, isn't selling CDs, but actually selling individual songs over the internet, then a mixtape would interfere with a lot of sales.
But record labels are still stuck in a very traditional mode of they want people to walk into a store to buy a CD, and that's the way that they can sort of count their chips. I think over time, they're going to have to find ways of adjusting to that. But so far, very few labels, especially the biggest labels, have shown the interest in making that transition.
Can you give me an example of an artist that has really benefited from this strange kind of viral leakage?
The most famous contemporary hip-hop artist who's benefited from mixtapes has probably been 50 Cent. And the reason why his example stands out is that these mixtapes that 50 was putting out basically served as unofficial albums. I mean, they were effectively albums because there were original material on there, and it was helping to create an awareness around him as an artist, and that eventually led him to get signed by Dr. Dre and Eminem and really propelled his career from then. I mean, by the point that 50 had put out his debut album, in some ways he had already put out 4 debut albums because of the mixtape.
Now, what's the difference between self-publishing a mixtape and self-publishing an album? Was there a DJ on his mixtape? Did it include other artists?
50 CDs came out through DJ Who Kid, and the mixtapes that they put out were originally a collaboration between Who Kid and 50, and it was sort of mutually beneficial. Having an up-and-coming artist of 50 Cent's caliber helps raise Who Kid's profile, but Who Kid's popularity as a mixtape DJ gave 50 Cent an instant audience in terms of recording with him.
So a mixtape is a way for a fan to get the jump on new music. Who's buying him?
The sales of mixtapes used to be very regional. The only way that you could get DJ Clue tape is if you lived in New York. But with the advent of internet sales, it's really expanded the market. You've seen this happen with a lot of Southern artists who've really benefited from the exposure and having people in the Northeast and California buy their tapes. But certainly a lot of these mixtape distributors and dealers sell a lot of music overseas. And I researched a story on mixtapes, found out that the military is actually one place where a lot of these tapes are going to, because soldiers out in the field don't really have very many other means of accessing new music.
All right. Oliver, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Oliver Wang is editor and co-author of Classic Material, The Hip-Hop Album Guide. Soldiers send for those mixtapes, just as in earlier wars they imported music from home when they could, and often they were honored with songs inspired by the very wars they were fighting. One of the biggest hits of 1917 was written by George M. Cohan as the Yanks headed across the Atlantic to fight the Boche.
Red, white, and blue, over there.
During the Vietnam War, Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler famously took control of his own musical destiny. He co-wrote Ballad of the Green Berets while recuperating from a wound incurred in action. It was a number one hit for 5 weeks in 1966.
Men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Berets.
But Sadler was stateside. You'd need a technical revolution before yet another sergeant, Neil Saunders, would be able to produce Live from Iraq, a rap album recorded and produced in a makeshift studio while on deployment in Baghdad, while fighting in Iraq. 15 tracks of music chronicled the inner life of Sergeant Saunders and five fellow soldier musicians with the 1st Cavalry Division deployed from Fort Hood in March of 2004. The group called itself Fourth Quarter, because it seemed that's where they were at in the game of life.
Welcome to the fourth quarter. It's live from every day. It's like a gamble here. This is no joke. This is live from my rack. When we pray and we make it home.
The whole album, in a sense, is chronological. From, you know, you have the deployment, and that's, we're on our way there. Then you have Live from Iraq. That's as soon as we've experienced, you know, what this war thing in Iraq is truly about. And then from there, it goes into the mentality.
Sleep the body on my blankets. Kevlar pillows in a country where when anybody's talking, they lying. And wherever there is a soldier, there is shrapnel flying.
We'd all been doing music for a while. But when it came time for us to deploy, we thought like the music thing was going to be put off for a whole year. You know, that changed as soon as we pulled into Iraq. You know, so much started happening, so much was going on. And we were just like, you know, if we ever considered ourselves artists, how could we not write about the most influential moment in our life? And that's pretty much how the whole album came about.
Would you say that Live from Iraq is in any way a message album? Does it come down on one side of the debate or the other on whether we should be there fighting to begin with?
No, it really doesn't. You know, we didn't take sides. The fact is that we're there, and now it's a matter of life or death to us. What it does say, and the side that it does take, is on that side of the soldiers. It seems like a lot of people don't understand that, you know, just like a surgeon does surgery, soldiers fight. So I guess the one issue that I'm really taking up is the fact that you have soldiers out there, and you're not letting them do what they've been trained to do.
What weren't they trained for that they're asked to do over there?
I don't think I was ever trained for any type of a peacekeeping operation. You know, I've never trained one time to walk down range and shake some guy's hand or just talk to him. I never walked down to a target during any gunnery and like gave it a chicken or, you know, pulled a lamb off the back of a truck and say, hey, here you go. What we train to do is we take ammunition and we put holes through things. That's just what soldiers do. And that's where you get the songs like Behind the Screens and 24 Hours, you know, where we're talking about we feel like our hands have been tied.
Let's talk about 24 Hours. It's an incredibly powerful track. It's basically an explosion of frustration that seems to be directed at the Iraqis, all the Iraqis. Everyone who lives there is guilty.
When we kick in your door, there is no alibi. Everybody is guilty till proved otherwise. 'Cause they know when to close and nobody.
You know, what they're used to is an iron fist. Whoever tells them and stands by what they said is the person that they're going to listen to. So it makes it hard for us to go out there and accomplish anything because we simply can't be out there 24/7. So when they plant the IED in the street and it's right in front of somebody's shop, you know, they're not going to tell us who put it there, even though more than likely they saw who put it there, because they have to live the remainder of that day, you know, scared that this guy's going to come back if they tell us anything. It's like we give them money, we feed them, and then we still get shot at. And the rest of the country there is like, wow, you mean these people can like be engaged in firefights all the time and we're still getting food and being taken care of as if nothing's happening? These people have to be the stupidest people in the world.
But it's not the same people necessarily who are firing at you who you're feeding. They're different people.
You know, it's you probably get a good feeling when you think that, but that's not the truth. We've dropped off aid before, right? And then you'll see the insurgent males. They'll come around and they'll tell everybody to back off of the food. They'll take all of it. They'll go leave. And then 20 minutes later, RPGs, AK-47s going off, ambush right there. After they got what they want, they're going to ambush you.
You say that you don't take a side in the album, and it certainly is democratic in that, with the exception of your fellow soldiers, everyone is a target of your anger. Your commanding officers, peaceniks back home, your girlfriends, and especially the Iraqis that you're fighting. There's one song called Behind the Screens. It seems to be about the war planners, the ones who make the decisions.
Yeah, that song touches about every bad decision that was ever made. You probably remember when the one soldier brought up the question about the 1114s, which is the up-armor Humvee that they have over there, correct?
Right. He asked Donald Rumsfeld at a town meeting with the soldiers why they had to reinforce their own vehicles with scrap metal from local landfills, and it later came out that a reporter had actually planted that question with the soldier.
Yeah, exactly. But that was a very good question, though. You know, the simple fact of the matter is you can go to any base in the green zone, and there'll be one 2004 Tahoe for every American contractor that's there, you know, all with leather, all, you know, with alloy rims. And you're wondering, wow, you know, there's money to attract these people to the effort here in Iraq, but there's no money to get a soldier in 1114.
And I've been through y'all's day, yo. I see how y'all work it. Tahoe is suburban for every civilian there working. But it's too much for 1114 here. Am I not worth it? Or is it okay to send me to war with something that's not working?
Did your commanding officers know about this project?
That's a good question. I think they knew that we were recording something.
But they looked the other way?
I don't even think they looked the other way. I just think that they misunderstood the seriousness of the album. I think they thought it was going to be just a traditional rap album. You know, we're talking about going to the club and women, and the stereotypical role of a rapper, I guess, is what they thought we were going to play. But they just didn't understand the seriousness that we were taking.
In Reality Check, you seem to have some pretty strong words for rappers back home. You basically accuse them of being fakers, of claiming to know what it's like to be a soldier, but really having no idea.
Yeah, they don't have an idea. It's I understand that, you know, America's probably not the safest place in the world. You know, you can't go out all times of the night. But in comparison, it's just Americans have it so good. Seeing the difference between what these guys that call them soldiers on their albums, you know, go through compared to what your average soldier is going through on a daily basis over there, it's just not the same. And you have not reserved the right to call yourself a soldier by any stretch of the imagination.
I'm trying to believe you and everything y'all are telling me, but I've seen soldiers firsthand, and it's not what y'all selling me. So could you please pull your brand from the shelf? And any more songs identifying you with me, keep them to yourself. Cause though you may have stood behind us, you ain't never stood with us. Cause I ain't never seen you on the blocks here when a man was just hit us. And please don't think just cause you bought some fatigues and run around with your little guns playing war back home in the streets, that you could ever in any lifetime be a reflection of me. Cause I deployed to go to war and you ain't got the balls to leave.
Rap always sounds kind of angry to me, or most of the time. This record sounds absolutely enraged, and it seems that much of it is spent in trying to justify the decisions that you make and the choices you feel you don't have.
Well, you obviously feel like you have a loss of any amount of control that a normal person should have on their life. The simple fact that you know, the ROE stands as so. ROE is the rules of engagement, that if I'm engaging an enemy that's returning fire on me, when he drops his weapon, I have to stop shooting at him. And that's ridiculous. Letting them live after they shot at you. Me, I'ma kill them. I'm only trying to make it home, but y'all have painted me the villain. And no, it's never that simple. We are forced to respond, while y'all pretend to yourselves it ain't going on. How many soldiers y'all have seen dead for you sing the same song? Me, I took the gloves off soon as I saw one.
And so basically you're saying you're asking us to do your dirty work, to follow rules that will have us killed, and you aren't going to feel guilty about killing civilians.
Well, as a soldier, I'm not going to feel guilty about killing anybody because, like I said, it's a matter of life or death for every soldier that's out there in the dirt. And people back home may not understand that. You know, we're over there and our weapons are on safety and we can tell where we're being fired at from. But until we see somebody with a weapon, we can't shoot in that direction. And that's a lot of the anger that we have.
Who are you hoping hears this record?
I think this is something that everybody needs to listen to. A lot of soldiers have told me that before they listened to the album, they couldn't open up because they didn't know what to say. They thought maybe they were the only people that felt the way that they felt.
Just one last question, and this may be a weird question given that the album is so dark, but do you have a favorite song?
I love all of them, all 15. And I also like, you know, the album isn't dark. The album is what it takes to make it out of there. The album was our light.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sergeant Neil Saunders served with the 1st Cavalry Division in Iraq. While there, he produced the hip-hop album Live from Iraq, and you can find out more about it on our website, onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer, Josh Nathan Casas, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.